You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 27th of April 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, and Hugo MacDonald.
Coming up on today's programme, we take the temperature of the photographic market as both Deutsche Börse and Sony open their prizes.
Also ahead, Sundance has spread its wings and landed in London for a second year running. We'll get a taste of some of the films on offer.
My name's Paul Raymond. Welcome to my world of erotica.
So we are leaving this dreadful place.
The water before you is somehow special.
Whoa, it's me.
Gosh, and for today's City Guide, we're headed to the American West Coast.
For those in need of a healthy dose of culture, San Francisco is the place to be over the coming days.
Plus, we'll welcome back our music reviewer, Joe Muggs, who'll teach us how to stay up all night. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review, here on Monocle 24. So a busy hour ahead of us. Francis is waiting in the wings. Francis Hodgson has just arrived, and we'll be talking about photographs at the two big exhibitions in London at the moment, including the Sony World Photography Awards coming up in just a second. But in the meantime, what's been your cultural highlight of the week, Hugo?
Well, Emma, hello.
Hello.
It's been a fairly dry week culturally for me, I'm ashamed to say. I think maybe I had OD'd in Milan at the Furniture Fair a couple of weeks ago. I'm still reeling through the wealth of material that I came back with from there. But I have been downloading quite a lot of new music.
And what we've discussed about this before we came on air. You've been downloading Haim.
I have been. And I can't work out still if I'm a little bit late to the party with my love of these three sisters from America who go by the name of Haim. We had one of their songs, Don't Save Me, on the playlist for a few months now, I think, and I loved it. Everybody said they are the successors to Fleetwood Mac.
And you can hear it very strongly in what they do. I was a big fan of Haim until I saw them perform on the television. And my perception of them got changed very quickly. And in a way that actually I hadn't experienced for quite a long time, when the music suddenly got taken over by the visual aspect of these ladies.
And what was it about the visual?
They just looked like three really sour-faced girls. And and I'm sure they're delightful, and I'm sure they're lovely.
Right.
But I think you saw the same television programme.
I did.
One
I know
of them
what you
was
mean.
One pulling of them. A face, and I did turn into my old. I turned into my granny, and I was like, "Ladies, if you're going to be on television, brush your hair, make
close
an effort.
Mouth.
You've got some lovely music. Just please pull yourselves together and sing."
Apparently, in the industry, it's known as a bass face. She was giving a very good bass face.
It wasn't a good bass face. It wasn't a face of any kind.
Well,
no.
Listen to the music, such as the joy of, music that you don't have to always watch it.
My cultural highlight was slightly schizophrenic this weekend. I went to the Deutsche Börse Photography Prize, which we'll be talking about in a moment with Francis Hodgson. Secondly, I went to London Zoo. I thought it was about time that I went to London Zoo, having not experienced a zoo since I was a very little person.
And
it was a sunny day in London, and I thought, right, I'm going to have a look at the zoo. And they have done a beautiful job. It costs an absolute bomb to get into. It's 25 English pounds, which is prohibitive if you just think that you're going to, it's hit and miss whether the animals are actually going to be out of their their sleeping holes to come and have a look. But it was beautifully laid out, beautifully put together, very welfare aware, and all in all a very pleasant place to be. And I had never really considered a zoo as being a pleasant place. I had, all you hear is of bad things.
Horror
to
stories.
Do with
I horror know, and stories. I think the longer you don't go to a zoo, the more you build it up in your head about
And then I walked in and it was wonderful. And you know, you see a tiger and you go, wow, that's a tiger. This is brilliant. It's really exciting. So I was heartened by London Zoo and thoroughly recommend it for a delightful, pleasurable, soothing afternoon.
So better than Deutsche Börse?
A different kind of kettle of fish, one would argue. It took longer to get round the zoo. But great exhibits in both counts.
Exactly. We can hear more about that shortly. In fact, very shortly indeed. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
And as we've just been discussing, we turn to the tricky realm of judging photography. Opening its doors a week ago at London's Photography Gallery, Photographer's Gallery, was the Deutsche Börse Prize, an award given to a living photographer of any nationality for significant contribution in Europe.
A little closer to the Thames, at London's Somerset House, the Sony World Photography Awards exhibition opened to the public yesterday. 32-year-old Norwegian photographer Andrea Gjestvang scooped the top prize for her portraits of children who survived the July 2011 massacre on the island of Utøya outside Oslo.
So how do these exhibitions compare? Should we indeed compare them? And what do they tell us about the state of international photography today? Well, here to give us his take on things, I'm delighted to say, is Francis Hodgson, who is a photography. I'd love to be able to introduce you properly, Francis. It'll take me all day. A photography critic for the Financial Times and the former head of photographs at Sotheby's in London. Francis has also previously chaired the panel of judges at the Sony Awards. So we'll get a delightful insight in just a moment. Francis, a very warm welcome to the programme.
Good morning.
Do we dare compare these big exhibitions? Because in terms of scale, they are poles apart.
They're quite different. It's not just in terms of scale. I mean, one of them is a relatively open submission where people want to be entered. Another of them is selected by a panel that is, as it were, almost a curatorial choice by the gallery. They're quite different things. There are four shortlisted photography sets of photographs in one of them. And there are, I think, 24 categories, each of which has got three shortlisted people and a winner in the other. They're quite different. At another level, one is quite specifically an art show and has to be judged, stands or falls, by its artistic qualities, whatever they may be, and the other is not. It's a photography show. The things are to be seen as images and they're good for reproduction. They're good to be seen in any circumstances, but they're not specifically designed to be seen on a wall in a frame.
Francis, I want to leap in and start with Deutsche Börse and ask you what your thoughts were on that this year, because me and Emma were talking about it before we came on air and saying that we find it a little bit confusing.
Yes, it could be seen as confusing. I mean, it's been going a long time. It likes to boast that it's the premier artistic photographic prize in the country. It has tremendous status and therefore a degree of importance. It seems to me that the criticism I would make is it's not very clear quite from which pool they're selecting their candidates. So you look, I mean, in particular, of course, you see a lot of the work this year is manipulated in one way or another. And then you have this man, Chris Killip, who's an extraordinarily eminent British photographer. But the work that's on this display dates from the 1970s and 1980s, although it's been reshown in various formats since. So I know it's not just myself. I mean, the whole London photographic world looks each year at these strange, tiny selections and thinks, well, what is it that they are the best of that doesn't correspond to something that somebody else is doing at the same time? Now, they're all quite interesting groups of pictures, but the judges or the people behind the judges haven't made clear which pool they're fishing in to get these fish out. So the first thing one says is, yes, of course, it is quite confusing.
It's a difficult exhibition insofar as, like you say, it's impossible to compare the four photographers because of the nature of their work. And one thing that actually disappointed me quite profoundly is the fact that two of the entries, the pictures taken by the side of the road by, I think it's Mischa Henna, of the prostitutes in Italy and Spain, are taken off Google Images.
Yeah.
So they're not actually, they're selected from an existing, you know, amount of material that's already there. And secondly, the Adam Broomberg and Oliver, is it Charnerin?
Yeah.
They take a Bertolt Brecht book and superimpose pictures that they have grabbed again off the internet in order to sort of portray some sort of strange layering effect of the horrors of war and the terrors of war. And the first thing I thought was, why am I looking at pictures which I know already?
Well, I can't say I have any objection to the processes involved. I mean, it seems to me absolutely it's been 30 years or more that people have been adopting, adapting, reusing, recycling, repurposing all sorts of imagery. That's part of photography. We have to deal with that. That's easy. I'm more concerned, and as you know, we spoke about this before, your thought about Google. Two out of the four shortlisted portfolios take their pictures from Google, as far as I know, without any acknowledgement. Now, the liberal arts establishment all over the world has been complaining furiously for a number of years about Google taking intellectual property from other people, or making a bit bold with intellectual property so that even if there isn't ownership there, there's certainly some discretion being trodden on. It seems to me very odd that a public-funded gallery in central London should be acknowledging the high-handed, to say the least, treatment of other people's intellectual property in these works. Quite apart from whether one likes to or likes or responds to the works, there is a really interesting question there. I would love to know if Mischa Henner and Broomberg and Shanarin have actually cleared their usages with Google. They are using them for what are ultimately commercial purposes. And the Copyright Act, as far as I know, says that there must be a fee paid or permission granted if commercial purposes are involved. So it's very, very odd that the Photographers' Gallery and the Deutsche Börse itself, the chief sponsors, are standing behind something without any explanation, which may be a brave and radical gesture, but I think it's more something where they've allowed their guard to slip a bit. I don't think they
really
think...
Really, you don't think it was on purpose to bring this out into the open as a viable topic of discussion for people to actually once and for all clear up the parameters?
Well, it may be. It may be, in which case I'm ill-informed, but I don't think so for a moment. Mm. I think what's actually happened here is they thought they'd get away with it, and I actually think that, frankly, if I were Google, I would challenge them in the courts, because we equally from the other side would have a right to challenge Google for the kinds of intellectual property slippage that I'm talking about. So I don't know the answer, but it seems to me that every viewer to the show should at least be asking themselves, what does it mean to repurpose imagery without permission granted?
Which elements of the exhibition did you like?
Well, I mean, you start with the virtuoso, clearly. I mean, I've talked a little bit about how odd it is that these pictures are old, but Chris Killip is an extraordinary seer of what's in front of him.
They are outstanding pictures.
Killip was, I mean, he's one of the voices that nailed down the discomfort of Britain to the Thatcher period, and that he, I mean, I don't know how much one needs to go into the history of it, but he comes from the Isle of Man. He's one of those photographers that was closely associated with the northeast of England, in particular with the Side Gallery in Newcastle at one point. Killip has left England for a number of years. His base is in the United States, where he's a known academic leader of a photographic course. His importance, his visibility are absolutely unquestioned. I mean, he's as important a figure as Martin Parr in British photography. But it's very sad that he's not regularly being shown, that he doesn't have much representation in this country, that he seems to be more appreciated in the United States and elsewhere than he is in the UK. So right there, you have a bit of an indicator of something that's going on in British photography. Broomberg and Shanarin are, if you like, highly visible contemporary artists. Christina Middel is an emerging artist. She's made this entertaining series called The Afronauts. There are things one can say about it. But wherever the attention goes, it seems to me odd that this great, eminent, powerful, long-established senior British photographer only has to appear in a prize selection and is pretty rare to be seen on these shores outside that.
It's a strange, as a result, I found it a strangely laid out exhibition, because you had the exhibition of Chris Killip on the first floor when you went in, and you almost felt as if the bar was being set at that standard, because his photographs are just so brilliant. They are their lucidity and the fact that they just seem to scream talent right through them. They capture elements that I found that none of the other exhibits actually managed to achieve. And so you have this, you know, this member of the photographic canon being almost pitted against people who really I didn't feel as if he should be pitted against. And then once you'd seen Chris Killip's photographs, you then went upstairs to the next level. And that almost felt like an afterthought.
I mean, there's a trivial thing, but it's true that when you are invited in to view the show, the staff at the Photographers' Gallery show you up to the top floor first, and you then fall down like gravity. So that it's possible to say that
I was clearly given the wrong order. But they just said it's fourth and fifth floor, and off we went.
Fine.
So that's fine.
Fine. I mean, when I went, to, you know, the first time I went, they said fifth floor and come on down, and that made sensitive.
Well, in which case, take it back.
But I have to say, I don't think I entirely agree with you. The point is well made. But there's no reason why a great black and white, rather traditional documentary photographer shouldn't be seen to compete against these other usages and habits and practices. I don't mind that at all. What I do mind is the lack of clarity that says quite on which grounds they are being asked to compete. That clearly, I mean, Broomberg and Shanarin have made an interesting project where either for real or for fake, they've taken practically a whole edition of an existing book by Bertolt Brecht, and they've pasted into his already brilliantly effective photographic satire, a new generation of photographic satire taken from Google. Now, I have mixed feelings about that. I mean, I have to say it's a very moving thing to look at, that when you are in the room at the vitrines and these open pages of books where the old images are hidden, replaced by things like the torture scenes from Abu Ghraib, pictures that are deeply familiar over the last 10 years or so, but often anonymous, often hunted down from that kind of not very photographic clarity. And the old captions remain. So you have a reference to one previous horror powerfully underlined and made more satirical by another. But I have to say that a few years ago, the Chapman brothers took Goya's Horrors of War and they redrew on top of those things with a mastery which makes everything that comes behind it really have to fight for its place. Frankly, I don't think that Broomberg and Shanarin's work is good enough, by which I mean thoughtful and interesting as well as craftsmanlike enough, both of those things, to compete against the level-setting, the pace-setting piece of that kind. The Chapman brothers, if you remember, turned these tough, tough engravings by Goya, really tough engravings, into something where a hint of Mickey Mouse-type comedy leavened it, but at the same time satirised it.
Let's move on to the Sony World Photography Awards, if we may. A completely different beast here due to its size and its scope.
Yes, and as I say, a completely different beast in its intention. Sony are very, very clear. They made speeches at the awards dinner underlining very clearly that what they want to do is to reach out to practicing photographers, both commercial and emerging, all over the world, with a strong impulse to use and to become familiar with gear. So it's quite clear that this is different from the outset. The principal sponsor at the Photographers' Gallery is the Deutsche Börse, which is not involved in photography or imaging. Sony are, and that changes everything from the outset. Second thing, it's a year-long program that these people have, which involves, you know, workshops and minor competitions elsewhere and teaching and reading and writing. The awards evening is a kind of crescendo which advertises and brings attention to a year-long program that Sony quite virtuously are doing all over the world. There is access through the websites to various kinds of Sony-sponsored photographic activity. In some ways, I have to say that I'm a greater admirer of that than I am of the gala evening when one, you know, can shake hands with a star photographer. And I presented one of the prizes myself the other day, and it's a great pleasure to do so and so forth, great honor to do so. But actually, it's not really about this one awards evening. So,
Francis, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. We've run out of time. Francis Hodgson, thank you very much for joining us here on The Review. If you are in London, the Deutsche Börse Prize can be seen at the Photographers' Gallery in Soho until the 30th of June, and the Sony World Photography Prize is on at Somerset House by the Thames until the 12th of May. Stay with us here on The Review, because up next we cross to Nelly Gotcheva for her whistle-stop tour of some global cultural highlights for this weekend.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
Well, I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban when I was 26 years old, and I sort of just saved my money and went to photograph women living under the Taliban. And now I realize, wow, that was pretty dangerous.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week shows for an hour of essential listening.
A fair at the end is on the one side a market platform, but I think especially here in Asia and in Southeast Asia, it should also be a place of an exchange, of a get-together.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
The May issue of Monocle turns its attention to the world of design, with a directory of all the things you need to build a better home. But we also get out our tape measure to size up how design can save a city, revive an island economy, put the life back into a faded business, and help a media brand rise above its rivals. But there's so much more this month.
In the affairs section, we visit three cities on the rise. We're in Medellin, no longer a drugs capital, Be'er Sheva, Israel's new hope, and Pondicherry. It's Indian, but a little bit French. Also, I sit down with Mexico's new president, Enrique Peña Nieto.
In the business section, we meet the wool pioneers that are taking Merino beyond the humble sweater. We focus in on a pair of Parisian spectacle makers and get management tips from a Danish Oscar winner.
In culture, we head to Oz to monitor the hotly fought battle for the mornings across TV, print and radio, proving breakfast is the most important meal of the media's day. We'll also look forward to London's fledgling photo art fair, and we'll sing the praises of the audience as the key part of a concert.
The May issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how to get on board.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Emma Nelson, where it's time to get a taste of what's happening around the world over the coming days with our associate editor, Nelly Gotcheva.
This weekend is your last chance to see the work of American photographer Ansel Adams at the National Maritime Museum in Southeast London. It features 100 original prints exploring Adams' lifelong fascination with water. For more details, go to rmg.co.uk. In New York, the Museum of Modern Art hosts a new exhibit by pop art sculptor Claes Oldenburg. On show are The Street and the Store, both made in the early 60s in the East Village, and Oldenburg's later piece, Mouse Museum, Reagan Wing. For more details, go to moma.org. For those of you who feel like watching a nice foreign film this weekend, we suggest White Elephant, or Elefante Blanco. Directed by Argentinian Pablo Tropero, the drama sheds light on the social struggles of his native country through the eyes of two priests working in the slums of Buenos Aires. White Elephant is now out at select cinemas across Europe. And back in London, the Contemporary Graphic Arts Festival, Pick Me Up, is wrapping up this weekend after 11 days of exhibitions and workshops on everything graphic art, design and illustration. Head to Somerset House, where galleries Handsome Frank and Soma are showcasing the latest designs from James Joyce, Sarah Maycock and Ben Javens, among others. This weekend, we'll be listening to some nice house tunes by Berlin-based David August. His new album, Times, is out now. Let's hear Until We Shine. Bring me back, bring me back. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
And that was Until We Shine by David August, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva.
You're listening to The Review, and it's time now for our weekly music review. Joining us again after his sterling performance at the beginning of the year is journalist and DJ Joe Mugg, specialising in everything from club culture to the more arcane and bass-heavy end of the dance music spectrum. Joe writes regularly for The Wire, Mix Mag and The Arts Desk. He goes out for us who don't. Welcome back to the programme, Joe. You were out last night. Thank Where did you, you go?
It's very nice to be here. It's sleep deprived though I might be. I went out last night to a pub gig at the Victoria in Mile End, not my usual stamping ground. It was a lovely music pub, and my friend Joel Culpepper was playing a showcase there. He's an old school soul man on stage.
Always good on a Friday night. Now, we must, before we move on to your choices, the big event in dance music, at least this week, was Daft Punk.
Yes.
I have fallen in love with this piece of music and have listened to it constantly, and it is still not tiring for me. Hugo's having issues with it already.
I might be a couple of days ahead of you, because I fell in love with it on release day at the beginning of the week, and then listened to it almost constantly, and then it kind of took on a life of itself, and I can't go anywhere without hearing it. And it has really grated on me, but I wonder if I'm just peculiar, or do you think that's the way it's
been quite a week, though, in terms of the fact that I can't remember the last time a piece of music did this.
No, I think it's enormously exciting. It's great that Nile Rodgers is having this like huge lease of life. I'm very much in the completely in love with it camp. It makes my spine tingle still hearing it. Having said that, I tend to live quite a hermit life. Being a freelance writer, I spend an awful lot of time just in my own office. So I'm not out and about in shops and restaurants a lot. And I don't take in a lot of TV or radio apart from Game of Thrones. Although it popped up on the ad break in Game of Thrones.
It's
absolutely gone absolutely everywhere. So we'll see. We'll have a little Daft Punkometer to see at what point we all just want to say, please. Shut up, we've had enough. But for the moment, it's still beautifully fresh in my mind. You've brought choices of three or four tracks that you wanted us to hear this week. Mm-hmm. The first one is Nevada Basin Foresight. Tell us why you wanted us to hear this.
So that I could talk about myself.
You did this last time.
Yes. No.
We're going to have to ban you.
It's a great track from a new band, a Glaswegian band. And I just have a slightly odd relationship to the music of Glasgow. It's always been, for some reason, produced an awful lot of my favourite bands. This is representative of sound that is kind of strong there, because there's the Club Optimo, the DJs Twitch and Wilkes, who are the main DJs there, are, for my money, possibly the best DJs in the world. And they can mix anything. They have this incredible ability to chuck in anything from the Cramps to old acid house tracks, perfectly merged, and one of the sounds that kind of is a big part of their sound is this kind of new wave disco punk thing. It's quite a lot like LCD Sound System, that kind of thing, and this new band are a great example of that.
Let's have a listen. Going down the storm here at Studio One here at Midori House. That was Nevada Bass and Foresight, the choice of Joe Muggs, the DJ and journalist for this week's guest music reviewer on the review on Monocle 24. Thank you for bringing that track in. Let's move on to Colleen, Ursa Major Find, a slightly different piece of music.
This is there seems to be some sort of Folktronica revival happening.
See, that to me makes my... Oh, no.
Folktronica.
Tell me why I should love Folktronica. I'm being very mean about Folktronica and I shouldn't be.
It's one of those things that can be awful, you know, for ostentatiously bearded artisanal coffee house type situations. It's like very, very cliched mobile phone advert, nice twinkly sparkly fey pixie girlfriend sort of
tea dresses stuff. Running through forests and
yeah, exactly. But there was so much glorious stuff. It's almost exactly 10 years since it really sort of happened. And I went to one of the early Green Man festivals at Baskerville Hall on the Welsh borders, which was incredible. You know, when it was still only 1,000 people or something. And just to get it in that kind of campfire context and out in the country, it does feel really good. And the best bands have managed to abide. The Memory Band, a really good one. Tung, I really love. There was some great stuff by Ardem. I was thinking about all this new Folktronica stuff made me wonder what's happened to him. But and Colleen, I think, was one of my favourites because it's just... having seen her live, this is one of the things, you know, I hate that you have to see it live thing, but it certainly sort of brought it to life for me because she does this amazing stuff with a cello and chimes and bones on strings, and she plays all the instruments and loops them herself with all these pedals, and it's just very hypnotic as you see her building up these layers. So,
Well, shall we listen to Ursa Major Find by Colleen?
As I was walking by the Great Bear in the northern sky, I found the seashell missing from the shore below. As I was walking by the Great Bear in the northern sky, I found the seashell missing from the shore below.
Very ethereal. That was Ursa Major Find there by Colleen. Thank you very much for bringing that in, Joe Muggs, our music reviewer on The Review this week. Shall we move on to track three, which is Bacha Mar Khalifa?
Bacha, maybe? I'm afraid my Lebanese is not strong.
I think you're probably better than me.
It's a cover of a Serge Gainsbourg song, Ma Chanchose.
It is a cover of a Serge Gainsbourg song. Now, Bacha Mar Khalifa is a new discovery to me, although I find he's on his second album and has done various other projects as well. I just got it because the label sent it to me. Infine is a quite interesting French dance music label usually, but his album is absolutely astounding. It just goes right round the houses. Lots of kind of spiky new wave, Middle Eastern traditional and classical sounds, house music, pianos, really just an amazing stew, but all has this strong personality that runs through it. And this Serge Gainsbourg cover is actually completely ambient on the album. It's very brooding and sinister. And this is a remix by Ewan Pearson, who's super, super talented. He's worked a lot with Tracy Thorne, I think. He's one of the great remixes. Actually, his remixes are Gold Frap. His probably his best known and most amazing mixes. But he does something really sophisticated and lush with it. Just makes it luxurious, I think.
Let's have a listen.
Thank you.
Mashan Shores by Bahama Khalife, the Ewan Pearson remix, out at the end of this month, and the choice of Joe Muggs. We have one more track that you wanted us to talk about, Cloud Boat.
Yes. I probably conflict of interest once again, because I wrote the biog for the record label for these guys. but they're super interesting. They're from a mini scene around James Blake, who obviously is big news with his new album out at the moment. And they're old school friends of his, or I can't remember if they actually went to the same school or grew up on nearby streets in Enfield,
North London,
musical hotbed. Music. Yeah, and there's these guys, Cloudboat, who are a duo, and another guy, Airhead, who has an album coming out in a month or two, who is James Blake's guitarist. And I mean, you can hear similarities. There's a kind of strong folk influence, strong sort of sophisticated 60s, 70s singer-songwriter thing going on. This dubstep kind of spacious bass-heavy production. But each of these you know, James Blake, Airhead, and Cloudboat each have their own really distinctive style. And Cloudboat, in particular, really dark. Really, really dark. They both have heavy metal backgrounds, I was interested to find out. And they've kind of sublimated this into this dark electronic folky kind of stuff.
Well, we'll listen to it in just a moment. In the meantime, Joe Muggs, thank you so much for joining us here again on The Review. We look forward to welcoming you back later on in this year, but we might ask you not to bring your own songs again.
I only realised too late with this
one. We're going to operate a door policy with you, Joe, I think. Let's listen to Cloudboat and Dream.
Death is coming, rides into town on a horse to keep hold of the reins. He's knocking on everyone's door. He's knocking on everyone's door.
Cloudboat there and Dream, the final choice of Joe Muggs on today's review.
Well, it's time to cross now to San Francisco to hear what's coming up over the coming days. And our man there, Alistair G, is here to guide us through it.
For those in need of a healthy dose of culture, San Francisco is the place to be over the coming days. Brad Meldow, described by the New York Times as the most influential jazz pianist of the last 20 years, is playing a show at San Francisco's new $64 million Jazz Center, and another on Sunday. Across town, director Steven Soderbergh's 27th film, Side Effects, came out earlier this year.
I don't understand why this is happening.
You know her?
Would you have treated her differently if she was a man?
That's not what happened.
And what is going on?
But another topic will likely dominate the conversation during his talk at the Kabuki Theatre on Saturday, namely his recently announced decision to retire from the movies and commit to other art forms. If you're in the area, the event begins at 1 p.m. Pacific time. On Monday, there's a chance to witness the astonishing transformation of former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer, who resigned his post in 2008 after his dalliances with prostitutes became public. Seemingly rehabilitated, he's speaking about the role of money in American politics at the Jewish Community Center. And during the week, the Museum of Modern Art is showing Christian Marque's film, The Clock, a 24-hour-long montage of film clips referencing the time of day.
It will be 1 o'clock, precisely.
The museum warns that queues are expected, so those who need a break can head to the 33rd annual Steinbeck Festival, taking place from Friday and through the weekend in the writer's agricultural hometown of Salinas. Around 100 miles south of San Francisco, Salinas is regarded as the heart of Steinbeck country, which provided the settings for many of his works. For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alistair Gee.
Alistair G there. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. We'll be back next to discuss some of the films on offer at Sundance in London.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Emma Nelson. The Sundance Film Festival is enjoying a break from its usual home in Utah. This weekend, our very own home city is playing host to the second Sundance London.
The four-day festival takes place at the O2, formerly known as the Millennium Dome, and it premieres a range of independent films. There's also the usual Q&A director sessions, a dash of live music, and the odd party or two.
Well, our next guest is film critic and regular on The Review, Tim Robey, and he's here to tell us what's hot and what's not of what he's seen so far. Tim, welcome back to The Review. I actually want to start by asking about Sundance London itself, and at what point does a brand like Sundance turn into a brand rather than just an event that is based in one city? When does it sort of get the power to move to, across the Atlantic to London and set up shop there for a few days?
Yeah, well, I imagine they've been contemplating this for quite some time because it's now, 32 years since Sundance Festival was founded by Robert Redford. And this is only the second year that they've moved it anywhere beyond Utah. London is the only place they've kind of set this up. And so, you know, they've also decided they want to kind of spread the brand. It's a much smaller, more kind of select festival. So out of the 119 films that played this year in Sundance proper, they've chosen 21 British and American films to come over here just for the one weekend. So it's more of a kind of boutique event in a way. But then oddly, it's being held at the O2 Dome, which doesn't exactly scream kind of tiny, low-budget indie, does it?
No, it's almost not exactly intimate.
Yeah, which I think is a slight issue for them, to be honest. I think that there's a bit of a mismatch with the venue because I really like a lot of the films that they're showing and I've been enjoying watching them. But I think the venue is a bit of a problem.
Does the essence of the festival also change when it's scaled down so dramatically? And secondly, what does it offer that other film festivals don't anyway?
Well, it really wants to focus on the independent work, and what they've done is they've only chosen English language stuff. So in Sundance proper, you can see films from like 32 different countries. Over here, it's just British and American films. But then the focus on kind of low budget British films is really good, I think. And there's one in particular called In Fear that I really liked that they're showing, which was very encouraging to see. So I kind of like the way they're being quite kind of territory specific about the way they're doing it.
So right idea, perhaps wrong location in the city itself.
I think that might be something they could solve. Yeah.
Well, you'd hope so, fairly easily.
You mentioned In Fear.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit more about it.
In Fear is really good. So it's a very low-budget British kind of psychological horror movie. It's set in the middle of nowhere. It was actually shot in Bodmin Moor. And it's about a young couple who've only been together a couple of weeks, so they're not even really properly a couple yet. They're just sort of in that early stage of dating, and they're kind of joking about it being their two-week anniversary. And they're going to a festival, but the guy, who's played by this young actor, Ian de Castecker, decides to book in for a hotel the night before in the middle of this kind of woods. You know, it's kind of completely secluded and isolated. They can't find it. And he becomes kind of increasingly flustered, and it's like he's trying to impress his girlfriend, Alice Englert, but they can't find it. And they end up kind of circling around in a maze. It gets darker and darker, and things start getting very, very weird.
I love the sound of this. It brings back many references. Wrong Turn, was it?
Definitely that one.
Or
and
Dead
also,
End,
there's another one called Joyride, or they released it in the UK as Roadkill with Steve Zahn and Paul Walker. It's rather similar to that one as well. And The Hitcher as well, there's a bit of that of in course. There, because there's a third character who kind of gets involved too. But it's really, really kind of compelling and quite skillful. And I really like the way it's set up so that it's actually very tense at first because of the relationship between them. They're not really, they don't really trust each other. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's such a young kind of relationship that really anything can happen. You're not quite sure, you know, where you stand with these two people.
I think we have a little clip of In Fear.
Tom?
Whoa, it's me! It's me!
What?
Did you pull my hair?
No.
In Fear, there, directed by Jeremy Lovering. Gosh, I like the idea of that. I can't wait to see it myself. Another film that stood out for you is Upstream Colour. This is by Sam Carruth.
Shane Carruth.
Oh,
now,
Shane.
Cast your mind back to 2004. I don't know if you ever saw a film called Primer, but in 2004, Primer won the top prize in Sundance, and it was a very low-budget movie about time travel. It's about basically two guys setting up a time travel machine in their garage, and then it kind of got really, really disturbing because they start sort of stalking each other around in time. Mm. But that won the top prize, and Shane Carruth hasn't made a film since then. He's got had various projects which he's tried to get off the ground, but this is the first one that he's made. And it's completely fascinating and a real, I mean, it's totally head-spinning stuff.
It bears no resemblance to reality, does it? You're entering into a dream when you're watching Upstream Colour.
It's almost like a dream world. I mean, you sort of enter in and the rules of this strange game are established, which is very hard to describe. It involves people harvesting flowers, it involves pig farming, it involves people being kidnapped, involves Henry David Thoreau's novel Walden. There's all kinds of weird stuff going on. You kind of come out trying to piece it all together. It's like a fantastic jigsaw of a film. I've now seen it twice, and I do think it actually all clicks into place eventually.
Is it one of those films that you don't get and you don't mind not getting, and then you immediately think, I have to see this again?
Yeah, I would maybe compare Donnie Darko, something like that, where it's very sophisticated in terms of, you know, it's cutting back and forth between lots of different stories, and they're interlinked. There are sort of strange links between them, and something will happen in the pig farm, and then it will cause something else to happen between the two main characters. And it is crazy. It is a crazy film.
Crazy,
very
but
challenging.
Enjoyable?
I loved it, I must say, and I couldn't wait to see it again. Mm. Saw it in Berlin, and now it's here at Sundance London. I think it works better the second time. It's also beautiful, and the sound design, which won an award in Sundance, is incredibly immersive as well. It's like listening to an amazing kind of concept album.
Let's have a little listen.
The water before you is somehow special. It is better than anything you've ever tasted. Each drink is better than the last. Take a drink now.
Upstream Colour there, a little taste of Shane Carruth's latest offering. It sounds absolutely baffling.
It's bonkers. Really. It's bonkers. And what we heard there was brainwashing going on, which is the kind of, in a
obviously.
Way, the plot that you can kind of like describe at the beginning is that someone gets kidnapped and brainwashed and taught to do certain things, certain patterns of behaviour, which then kind of come back and you realise that she's sort of been almost impregnated by this process. But anyway, it's very, very weird. Very weird. I think it's amazing. I think people, it's going to be a real cult
Marmite
smash this film.
Though, by the sound of
possibly
things.
Marmite film. Most people I know who've seen it have loved it, I must say. It's gone down very well with the critics, I know.
How refreshing is it to see a film like this? Because, you know, for however long that we've done the review, I think this is the first film that we've talked about that doesn't seem to have a plot.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of does. It's just an undescribable plot. I mean, you really can't kind of get to grips with it unless you just sit down and watch it. I think it's great that Shankruth hasn't kind of sold himself out. He could, off the back of Primer, he could probably have done anything he wanted in Hollywood. Mm. But instead, he's stayed true to his, stuck to his guns and made this incredibly sort of intellectually challenging film. There's so much going on in it. I think it's going to be talked about a lot as it comes out in August, I think, here theatrically. But now's the time to catch it at Sundance London if you can.
Well, let's skip on to the third film. You're slightly less of a fan of this much-anticipated release, The Look of Love, which is the new Steve Coogan film directed by Michael Winterbottom.
I should say this is actually out this week nationwide as well, just opened. It's the fourth time that Steve Coogan and Michael Winterbottom have worked together, and I've really liked their other collaborations, particularly 24 Hour Party People back in 2002, which was the kind of portrait of Manchester music scene. I thought that was a fantastic use of Steve Coogan. And then they went on to do A Cock and Bull Story and The Trip on TV with Rob Brydon. I think Winterbottom's really good at using Steve Coogan to kind of author these films in a way, to be the dominant figure, and using that Partridgian kind of quality to kind of create these incredibly sort of slightly naff protagonists who are just a little bit, you know, they're kind of self-conscious. They don't quite know what they're doing, these guys. And in this one, I mean, here, it's a bit of a case of miscasting, I think, because Coogan's required to play Paul Raymond, who's the kind of king of Soho sleaze, basically, the kind of the baron of peep shows and stuff in Soho in the 1970s. And it's in some ways quite a conventional biopic in that we see him dealing with his relationships with his daughter, played by Imogen Poots, who's very good in it, and his wife, Anna Friel, and his mistress, who's played by Tamsin Egerton. And all the women are fantastic. I think Coogan is slightly straining for effect. And you see him kind of lapsing into doing impressions and stuff. He does an impression of Marlon Brando at one point, and you're like, you know, did Paul Raymond really, was he known for his celebrity impressions? It's kind of like Steve Coogan is kind of straining to entertain us.
Mr. Raymond, you've been called the king of the keyhole shows.
I like to think of myself as the king of the glamour shows.
It is such a good night to kiss.
Bravo to the future.
Would you say everything you touch turns to gold?
Not everything, but enough.
My name's Paul Raymond. Welcome to my world of erotica.
Tim, you mentioned there that Steve Coogan is often used as very effectively as a vehicle by Michael Winterbottom. And then you also mentioned that the Alan Partridge element, which I always find very difficult to shake off Steve Coogan. And I know you were talking about 24 Hour Party People. I had a problem with that film because having seen Anthony Wilson do his thing for real, it was impossible for it not to be Steve Coogan being the driving force of the film, and being Steve Coogan as opposed to being Anthony Wilson. Does he get away from it in this, or are we still watching a film with Steve Coogan dressing up as someone?
He's really trying to get away from it, and the script does actually try and sort of delve into the cost of his life and his excess in a way. And it's very sad because his daughter died in 1992, Paul Raymond. So that's a sort of a key part of the film. But it's almost as though the script is kind of bouncing along, and then occasionally it's like insert anguished close up of him looking at, you know, TV footage of his daughter being interviewed. And Coogan has to kind of do this kind of dark stuff, which he can sort of switch on. He's a capable actor. But then during the other stuff, he is just doing kind of Steve Coogan is Paul Raymond this time. I think it worked with Tony Wilson better because I think the script was really well matched so that everything he said just seemed a little bit pretentious and then instantly kind of deflated. And it was like, it was a good way to like puncture any of the kind of bombast that you can get when you talk about like epoch-making musical moments. You know, it's like it can very quickly get quite tedious, and it was aware of that. It was a very self-aware script, that. I think this one, it's trying to be self-aware, but it's just not nearly so sophisticated, and it feels kind of superficial to me.
Who is its audience?
Well, that's the big question. I think they're really selling it to a Partridge crowd. I mean, that line in the trailer, welcome to my world of Orozco.
Is like, I was going to say, you could hear that even then.
You hear Partridge instantly, and I just don't really buy it coming from that character. It's like we've imposed Coogan on the material, and not in a particularly skillful way.
Well, there's one more day left of Sundance London. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Well, head down there if we can.
At the O2. Tim, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here on The Review. If you are in London, as Hugo just said, there is still time to catch some of the films on offer at Sundance, which wraps up on Sunday. Just Google Sundance London and you'll find out where it is. I'm afraid that brings us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bulboa and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Annabelle Bly. Our studio manager was Claire Urban, and our thanks to all of them.
We're handing back over to Georgina with the weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune in to the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air on Sunday, that's tomorrow, at midday London time, with Andrew Tuck and Sophie Grove in the presenters' seats.
In the meantime, you've been listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Hugo MacDonald.
Goodbye. Thank you for listening.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.